I'm Jonathan Capehart, in today for Leonard Lopate. In 1966, Raquel Welch was thrust into international stardom with the release of the film 100 Million Years B.C. The poster featuring her in a doe-skin bikini became one of the most popular movie posters of all time, and Playboy magazine named her the most desired woman. She will turn, get this people, 70 this year, a fact she proudly admits in her new book, Raquel, Beyond the Cleavage, from Weinstein Books. In it, she discusses her life, her career, and what it's been like to go through life as an international sex symbol. I'm very pleased to welcome her to the Leonard Lopate Show today. Thank you very much for being here.
Hello, how
70.
Are you? Oh, well, I'm not 70 yet.
Not yet.
Let's
in
not
September,
push it.
In September.
And you added another 100 years to 1 million years B.C.
Oh. See, that's what I get for reading
well,
literally.
You want to make me older.
Sorry about that.
Sometimes
that
makes me look better.
That was just a film. But, I mean, stunning. People, I am telling you, she is stunning. So, were you inspired to write this book now because of that living milestone? Turning 70?
Not so much from the milestone, but because I felt that I had something to say now that I'm adult. I've sort of earned my right to sit at the table with the big folks, you know. Mm-hmm. I think that the thing that was the most difficult about the fur bikini role was that it lived, you know, had such a robust sort of legendary status all the time that it pretty mm-hmm. much eclipsed anything that had to do with my real self. And in the book, I even say that I think it's time to, pull back the veil and mm-hmm. reveal the authentic me. Mm-hmm. And I felt like I always loved to write when I was in school. And I thought, why don't I write? Why don't I write my feelings, my experiences? And because it's so singular to be a woman and a woman who's a sex symbol, maybe other women would kind of like to know about the ride that I've taken from childhood through adolescence, through, you know, puberty, all of that, and into being a young mother, a young wife, mm-hmm. all of those things, you know, right in through my career and through menopause. It's just, you know, it's quite a journey.
So when you were growing up, did at any point did you think, because I was tickled to hear you just say matter of factly, you know, dealing with being a sex symbol.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, did you ever think in your wildest dreams that would be attached to you?
No, I didn't think about it that way. I did know that people gave me attention because of my looks, and, you know, it was a little unsettling because that was not how I saw myself, but I was pleased about it, and the more it happened, the more kind of, you know, addictive it was, mm-hmm. and I liked it.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it a lot more than I wanted to like it.
Okay, so let's talk about the book. You reveal some things in the book you hadn't spoken about in public before, right?
Well, which are you speaking of?
Well, I mean, for instance, I was surprised to learn that at the time of the fabulous doe-skin bikini movie poster, you were the mother of two children.
Yes, uh-huh. Yes, that's why I was a little schizophrenic at the time, because mm-hmm. I had, you know, I didn't realize that this movie would have such a huge impact, and I felt that, you know, when it did, that I was happy about my break because I did want to be an actress. But I also felt it's kind of a very paradoxical that now I am this sex symbol and everybody is touting me as, you know, the new whatever, the new it girl. And I'm really a mommy.
Mm-hmm.
And my inside feminine instincts are drawing me, you know, to my children and a little bit guilty about not being able to spend more time with them and all discovering how time-consuming being an actress is.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of this big brouhaha about being the girl of the moment and all of the stuff that followed me around for years and years and years.
So let's go back to the beginning. You were born in Chicago, and your birth name was
Joe Raquel Tejada.
Tejada.
Yes, that's my father's name. My father was from Bolivia,
mm-hmm.
Of Spanish heritage, and my mother's his name was Armando Carlos Tejada. Are you ready for that?
Nice.
And my mother's name, who was actually her ancestry dated back to the Mayflower, her name was Josephine Sarah Hall. So you couldn't have bigger opposites. And, you know, and we were a family of three children.
Mm-hmm. And you were the oldest.
I was the firstborn, mm-hmm. Meant to be son. Mm-hmm. And then I had a brother who was actually born on the same day as I was, mm-hmm. But 2 years later, and then a sister, Gail.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so when you were two, you and your family moved to California, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm. And that's because it was the war mm-hmm. effort. I mean, it was World War II.
Mm-hmm. So what was your childhood like then?
It was a great childhood in lots of ways. Because I was living in sunny California, and but you know, as I called it in the book, the golden land of boredom, mm-hmm. and I needed to have some kind of active imagination to keep myself entertained, and I was always making myself into different characters in my mind and putting on plays in the garage and all of this kind of a thing. But you know, we had a kind of turbulent family life. You know, I write about it in the book. I think it's better for people to read it because of the intimacy of the whole thing. But my father was a very, how do we put this? He was a forceful, mm-hmm. domineering kind of a man. And it really did color everything inside our home life. And it very much formed the kind of a woman that I would become. And I was always very, very cognizant of the fact that my mother would acquiesce to him constantly, and that he was just, you know, he was just so demanding, and nothing was ever enough. And I, in a funny kind of a way, it really forged the kind of attitudes I had about being a woman.
Yeah, their relationship was... tempestuous. Tempestuous is, I don't think, does it.
Well,
justice.
I don't know if it was tempestuous because my mother took, it's difficult to say it actually, I think it's better to read about it. But he ruled the roost. He had the upper hand, and she accepted that, but at her own peril, because she had to make herself very small and kind of mm-hmm. suffered a certain amount of humiliation because of it.
And speaking of humiliation, which you write in the book, there's the milk story.
Yes.
And this was the
mm-hmm.
moment when you liberated
yourself.
I had to
confront my father because he did something unforgivable, and I needed to tell him that he couldn't do that ever again.
He tossed a glass of milk in your mother's face, because he didn't like the way the dinner was prepared. I can't remember if it was a casserole or something. He didn't like the mm-hmm. way it was prepared.
I see. I guess I didn't know we were going to get into this much detail, I'm not living here now, so I didn't know exactly.
It's a very powerful story because you have, at the time you're 16 and you're seeing this happen to your mother, and you see how deflated she became.
Well, you know, it was a kind of ongoing thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was like that for many, many years, building up to that point. And by the time I got to 16, I knew that I was the one of all of us mm-hmm. who was going to stand up to him, that it would have to be me. I kept waiting for somebody else to please do it, but there wasn't anybody except me. I was going to be the designated one, and I would have to take him on. And I did.
And you did. In that way, we've seen through lots of things. We saw Bill Clinton stand up to his stepfather when, you know, things got serious between his stepfather and his mom. And there you are. You know, you're being chased by him. You grab, I think it was a poker from the fireplace, mm-hmm. and that's when you stood your ground and said, you know, you will not do that.
Well, I was trying to stand up for my mother. I told him if he ever did anything like that again,
you'd
there was going to be big trouble.
No, actually, she wrote,
well, I think when
I
you're holding a
you.
Poker, well, I think when you're holding a poker in your hand, I think there's something rather symbolic about that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it is a blunt instrument, and it's also pretty phallic at the same time. So in a funny kind of way, I think I was saying, no, you know, I'm not, you know, I'm not going to be the subservient one. If it takes being a man around here, well, then I'm going to, you know, I'm going to be the one to have the weapon.
Did that change your relationship with your father from that moment on?
I think it did, because he was shocked. I think he was shocked. Because I wasn't that docile, but I did want to please him in every possible way. Mm-hmm. And I did love him very much. And his love was not unconditional, it was conditional. Mm-hmm. So if I did the kind of things that he liked, if I got perfect grades, if I dressed perfectly and I had the perfect vocabulary and I went on and, you know, there was a whole endless list. Everybody used to avoid him in our house because we didn't want to have to be criticized, you know, about something. Anything that he didn't think was right. Mm-hmm. But he was very strict, and so in a sense, I think I've lost my train of thought.
Well, then let's talk about Hollywood. And
oh boy, that's
jumping,
a big jump.
And jumping, right? and jumping into acting, because one minute you're, you know, mom, two kids, the next minute you're an international sex symbol. So how did you get discovered?
Well, you know, that's a kind of a big jump, Jonathan. Yeah. I think that what happened when we were talking about my dad is that, sorry to go back,
sure.
but just that, is that he realized that he had crossed a line and that now he was going to have me to deal with. Mm-hmm. And since I was 16, you know, it wasn't too much longer that I had, you know, before I married the love of my life at that time, my first husband, Jim Welch. And then we subsequently had two children, and he was not happy about that at all.
Which your father?
My father wasn't happy about me getting married
to Jim. Oh,
getting
married.
No.
Why?
But, well, he just wanted to pick the guy. Mm-hmm. And I knew that I wasn't having him pick my guy.
Well, who did he want you to marry, do you think?
I really don't know, but he was constantly trying to push me at this boy or that boy. And I just, whoever he picked, I did not want that guy.
Did those boys have anything in common, or just, they were just...
You know, in his mind, they were more suitable for me to get married to. And in my mind, I was not going to have a marriage of suitability. I was going to have a marriage of the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just made me into a full tilt romantic.
Mm-hmm. and so then how did you meet your first husband then?
High school. High school. Yeah. Jim Welch. I remember the day very clearly, and I have written about it in the book. The day that I, you know, was coming up the steps into high school to my American government class, and I suddenly saw this new guy leaning against the wall, and I thought, wow, I think I'm going to have his children. That was how quick it was.
Wow. And so did you go and talk to him? He talked to you? How did the conversation, that first conversation
start? You know, in my day, in the 50s, mm-hmm. Jonathan, you wouldn't know anything about that. But in the 50s, we moved slow, you know. Girls did not go and approach guys. That was just very déclassé. You didn't do that. I mean, you had to make them come to you. It used to be called the art of being a woman. But, you know, eventually, yeah. It turned out that through the grapevine and, you know, little by little, that he also thought that he liked me and I liked him, and eventually we got together, and he asked me if I needed a ride to school. And I thought, well, that was a big deal then, because I didn't live that far from the school. I could easily have walked, but he was one of the few guys with a car. And so that was, you know, I couldn't have been more delighted that Jim came and picked me up every morning. I mean, just that half a mile to the school was like, for me, you know, and unrequited bliss. It was incredible.
So we've learned two things about you through this story about how you met your first husband. One, that your name, Raquel Welch, was not made up by the studio.
No, that is
your name.
That is my name. And of course, I had two children Damon Welch and Tawny mm-hmm. Welch, which a lot of people will remember from Cocoon. She's an actress. Mm-hmm. And I did want to keep their name, I mean, keep the name that so that we were all of one name, my kids and I, mm-hmm. even after I left Jim to pursue a career. But that was a sad moment in my life. It mm-hmm. was a very sad moment because it was, you know, it was one of those terribly difficult choices that is just, it's heartbreaking. And yet you feel that you have to do something because it's been a dream for so long. It's been your whole raison d'etre. Mm-hmm. And then, but the sacrifice you have to make to follow that kind of an impulse is so hard to make. And it leaves a scar behind when you do that.
And I want to talk about your dream in one moment. I'm speaking with Raquel Welch about her career and her new book, Raquel, Beyond the Cleavage. It's published by Weinstein Books. We'll have more after a break. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm Jonathan Capehart in today for Leonard Lopate, and I am speaking with the utterly charming and fantastically beautiful Raquel Welch about her new book, Raquel, Beyond the Cleavage. It's about her life and her career, and I got so wrapped up in her story, I completely forgot to take a break when I was supposed to.
It's my fault. It's my fault.
No, it's not your fault.
I think I should say this is not a memoir per se. Mm-hmm. This is part autobiographical because you have to have some kind of context for
right.
who's talking. But a lot of it is just my personal philosophy about being a woman.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I want to talk about that, but I think we can't get there before we have to talk about the years in movies and Hollywood.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you were talking about before the break how you had this really tough decision to make between staying with Jim Welch and mm-hmm. pursuing your dream, pursuing
mm-hmm. my career as an actress.
Your career as an
yeah.
actress.
Yeah.
So how were you discovered, and then were you surprised by just how everything just took off for you?
Yes, it was all very unpredictable. I went to Hollywood with my two kids in tow. I didn't know anybody, didn't have any money to speak of, no car, and found that really it was even difficult to get an apartment there because all the apartment buildings said no children.
Mm.
And I thought, oh gosh, you know, I'm really persona non grata here. I don't know how I'm going to ever make it. It's such a long shot. But I just kept going and took some odd jobs and things. And then suddenly things just turned around. I got this little tiny walk-on part on the Hollywood Palace.
Mm-hmm.
It was a kind of like a poor man's Ed Sullivan show. Mm-hmm. But they had great big stars on it. They had Groucho Marx and they had Dean Martin and they had... so many big stars of the day, and they were the hosts, and I was just the billboard girl. But for some reason, it caused quite a stir because I had another one of those costumes, you know. But it's just, you know, it was like a little body costume.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing of it was that was great for me is I only had to work one day a week.
Ah,
and
perfect.
I got enough money so that I could pay my rent and buy groceries and gas. So this was terrific for me. I never thought about it as being a stepping stone. But the thing that happened is the people in the show were so nice to me. They wanted to help me. They saw how keen I was. I used to come to all the rehearsals and things like that. And they say, what are you doing here? You don't have to come until Sunday. And I say, well, I just heard Sid Charisse was going to be here today, and I just had to see. And I'm sorry, I needed to see Mick Jagger. Do you mind? Could I just sit into the... You know, so I would watch all these things, and I would just pick up everything about the way the show was made and done, you know, the orchestra rehearsals, the sound department, the lighting department, the scenery, the costumes, all of these things, and just see how it was. And they saw that I was very keen, and so they kind of put me in this other big television special called the Deb Star Ball, and I was one of these girls who was undiscovered sort of young beauties in Hollywood. And I got, one of the judges was a producer at 20th Century Fox, and I got a contract.
Hmm. Wow.
Boom, like that. I couldn't believe it.
Huh.
I mean, I'd worked there for about a year, but that was, you know, A big, huge break for me.
And so then was 1 million years BC, did that come from that?
Well, yes, it did. Yeah. My first movie was that I did on my Fox contract was the famous Fantastic Voyage, the science fiction epic.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. And I say in the book that it's forever that they put sexy girls, or who they think is sexy, in sci-fi movies. I mean, they're doing it with Jessica Alba all the time, and now Megan Fox. Mm-hmm. And so it's just the way they do it. And you're in these sci-fi things, and all you have to do is run around looking hot, and everybody just sort of sits back with their arms crossed and goes, uh-huh, we'll see how she does.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can feel the skepticism sort of just oozing out of every corner. So it feels a little uncomfortable, but that was really, I did Fantastic Voyage, and because of the special effects, it took so long for that movie to come out that when I went to the UK, to London, to do 1 Million Years BC, that movie ended up coming out, you know, first.
Ah.
The poster came out first, actually. That was wrong, what I just said. Scratch that. What I meant was that the poster came out first while I was filming, and that just made me a big, big old deal.
Right. And so then that happened, and that from those movies and especially that poster came a lot of offers.
Well, that made my career. Everybody knew who I was. Everybody, you know, I was what they call hot at the moment. I was, you know, that was my ticket to ride, and you know, that was huge.
Yeah.
That was a huge, huge, big break for me and my kids.
So, I mean, did you find being typecast as a sex symbol and nothing more?
Oh yeah, sure.
And did that bother you?
Well, you know, that the thing about that, Jonathan, is that, you know, it's such a cliche. I think that I was very happy about it because it's very flattering, you know, and it's, you know, it is a big break, and it really does come with a lot of other opportunities. But the opportunities are very of a certain nature.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have any other kind of ideas about how you would like your career to go, they're pretty... You know, all of those other kind of creative instincts have to be put on hold for a very long time.
You know, one of those creative instincts was comedy. And if we have it queued up, there was a scene in Bedazzled, which you were in, and you played one of the seven deadly sins. You played lust in this British film with Dudley Moore and Peter Cook.
It was Stanley Donen, by the way.
Oh.
Only the famous and great Stanley Donen.
Let's play that, and then I'm going to ask you something on the other side.
It's so hot in here. Would you help me with my buttons? I seem to be all thumbs this morning. So constricting. We must allow our pores to breathe. Oh, that's better. Can you hear my pores breathe? Listen.
You have to.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, well, that was pretty. I mean, that was one of my camp pieces that
when you see it.
I have a couple of those in my repertoire.
Yeah, and when you see it, the thing that I was struck by was, one, I mean, it goes back to something you were saying before, is that, well, I mean, you were the hot girl at the moment.
It was a joke. You know, the casting was a joke, and the movie was a joke, and it was the seven deadly sins, and...
Well, you were playing the sex symbol, but it also...
No, I was playing Lillian Lust.
Right, Lillian Lust, but I mean, when you see the scene, clearly you're a sex symbol, but it also allowed you to show a comedic side.
Yes, I thought that was a pretty bad performance, actually. I think I could do it better today.
But, you know, people said, or were saying that maybe perhaps you were the heir to Marilyn Monroe because you're so beautiful and, you know, the comedic nature of what you're doing there. But when I looked at the clip, I thought, wow, you know, Sophia Loren. I mean, we're talking, you know, beauty and hilarity. Because
that's a very flattering company to be in. But I'm afraid I didn't stumble upon Vittorio De Sica as my director. I should have been so lucky. Then I could have done something a lot better than Lillian Lust. I mean, Lillian Lust was great fun because it was Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, mm-hmm. and I've been living in London, and they were the two biggest, hugest stars of Great Britain at the time, and they're just hysterically funny. I was crying with laughter all the time, so it was wonderful. And Stanley Donen is an incredible director, so it was kind of a lark. I mean, it really was nothing more than a cameo for mm-hmm. me, but they did revive the movie and all over again. And it was Elizabeth Hurley that played Lillian Lust, and she did a darn good job of it. To tell you the truth, I think she did a much better job, but it was a bigger part and a different kind of a role mm-hmm. when they did that.
Now, we're running out of time. I'm Jonathan Capehart sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and we're talking with Raquel Welch about her new book, Raquel, Beyond the Cleavage. Now, when we started... This book also has, as you said, advice to women
yes.
on how being a woman.
Okay.
I don't want this interview to end without you imparting some of your advice, or some of your words.
Here's from page 262. Women, in general, in my opinion, after all of our gains and all of the advances we've made through feminism, still have a kind of a chip on our shoulder, a little kind of a legacy of resentment that maybe we're the second sex and all of this. And I like to say that our demons lurk in the war of ideas inside our heads, and the cold war of the sexes still flares up and spills over into the home, the classroom, the boardroom, and not surprisingly, into the bedroom, where some feisty women have adopted the role of sexual predator. So analogous to the stereotypical male behavior.
Ooh.
So that's one statement.
Well, so then I have to ask, what do you think of this? We're all talking about cougars.
Oh, you
in
are.
In popular culture. what's your view of cougars?
What's my view of cougars?
I mean, do they
cougars
fall into the line of sexual predators?
Yes, I think they do. And you know, I like Corky. Courtney Cox, I think she's having a great lot of fun with this role as a cougar. But, you know, I still can't get over the fact that, what is she, 42 years old and she's supposed to be older? I don't see so much older. That doesn't sort of jive with my idea of an older woman. I mean, she's in her prime as far mm-hmm. as I can see. I mean, any guy would be lucky. You know, that she might be interested. But, you know, we still see women at the age of 40 as being somehow handicapped. And I personally think that that's a time when you come into yourself and feel comfortable in your own skin, have a lot more to offer, and where life really becomes rich in so many ways. And because we are constantly developing. And my book is less about how, you know, ideas about how not to grow old, then how fabulous the opportunities are as you get more mature to live your life and really live it fully, instead of tackling all of the learning process that comes in mm-hmm. the earlier years. You now know something.
Now, when you turned 40, you let the world know about it.
I did.
In a town and in an industry where 40 is not exactly a welcome number.
That's true. Well, I always had more guts than brains. I just thought that I was, I was 40 years old. I was feeling very bullish about myself. I thought, well, this is all fine. Everything's held together very nicely. Why should I apologize for it? Let's celebrate. And I think I was right to do so.
I was about to ask, do you regret doing that?
I don't regret doing that. But I will say, and I do talk about in the book, that because of doing that, when I ran into a kind of a difficult situation legally with some people, that when we got with MGM Studios at one point, this is so difficult, it's impossible to really cover it appropriately in this interview, but when it came time to go to court about it, they sort of said I was too old to be playing that part. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I was not too old to play the part because they'd invited me to play it. And I was playing opposite Nick Nolte. I don't see anything inappropriate about that casting.
Well, you know, I'm sorry to cut you off, but we are running out of time, and you've got a lot of events that I want to tell people about, and we've been speaking
and
with.
And if you, I got to add this. Yeah. If you're going to talk about my comedy achievements, you know, Three Musketeers was the comedy performance you want to concentrate on, not Lillian Lust.
All right. So, okay, you're going to be speaking and signing books tonight at 7 at Union Square, Barnes & Noble, and tomorrow night at 8, you'll be in conversation with Dr. Gail Saltz at the 92nd Street Y.
Yeah. That's right.
And the other events are on the show page on WNYC.org.